Welcome to Walter Edgar's Journal. With me in the studio today is Clay Bonnyman Evans, who has written a book entitled Bones of My Grandfather, Reclaiming a Lost Hero of World War II. It's not just history, it's investigation on his part and private organizations, not just the government. It's a fascinating story. And with that introduction, Clay, welcome to the Journal.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You live part-time in Hilton Head. You know South Carolinians like to know, who are you, your people, how did you get here, that kind of thing.
You know, when I talk about South Carolina, I can very honestly say I have a very new connection and a very old connection. So my new connection is that I have lived on Hilton Head Island for most of the year since 2015. My old connection is through my mother's mother's family. I am a direct descendant of John Rutledge.
Oh.
And y'all probably know who John Rutledge was.
Oh, yes.
The second Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, governor of Carolina prior to the independence.
Yeah. So what brought you to South Carolina?
Several years ago, my wife's mother moved down to Bluffton from New York, where she'd been most of her life. And unfortunately, she lived here for a few years, and then she got sick and died, left us a house. Well, we had gotten tired of winter in Colorado, and we thought, you know, we could sell our house here and move down to a place that we've been and we loved. So we went ahead and moved to Bluffton. Then I promptly went overseas to Tarawa, which is the subject of this book. And when I came back, I found out my wife, all on her own, had decided she didn't want to live in Bluffton, preferred Hilton Head, nothing against Bluffton. And so I came back to a new house, and we do live on Hilton Head.
And you spend your time between there and Boulder, Colorado.
Yes, sir. My mother and my sister still live in Boulder, and I go back for about 4 months of the year, mostly to help my mom and also just because my wife and I are both big outdoor people. And we did learn pretty quickly that summer down in the Lowcountry is a little bit oppressive.
Oh, you mean you don't like Hilton Head in August?
You know, I don't want to say I don't like it. It's beautiful. I love the heat. My family comes from a lot of it comes from the South. So I've been coming to the South my whole life. I used to think of heat and humidity by the scale of the North Carolina mountains. I thought, oh, well, I like humidity. It's a nice change from the dry of the West. Well, I had not understood humidity until summer in Hilton Head and also in Pennsylvania on the Appalachian Trail. So, no, not in August.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get into the story. And first of all, talk about your granddad. You never knew your granddad, obviously. Your mom was very young when he died. So what was the story that you learned about your grandfather, Alexander Bonnyman? They called him Sandy, right?
Yes, sir.
Growing up.
What I really can say honestly is that my grandfather's legacy looms very large over that part of my family, the Bonnyman family. He was born in Atlanta, grew up in Knoxville, Tennessee, so that's kind of where the family was for many years. His father was a Scottish immigrant who married my great-grandmother, who was the daughter of a plantation family from Rome, Georgia. And Alexander Bonnyman Sr., my great-grandfather, started a coal company that was quite well known and did a tremendous amount of business throughout the 20th century called Blue Diamond Coal Company. So they were fairly well off, well known, well connected. My grandfather, just to get to the heart of the story, in 1942, signed up to join the Marine Corps. He was 31 years old at the time he put his pen to paper, which meant he was too old for officers school, and much, much older than the grunts that he was going to go to basic with. But that's what he wanted to do. About 18 months after he left his family, not quite that long, he was killed in the Battle of Tarawa, November 1943, and posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. So my mother, as the oldest child, she was nine when he was killed, seven when he left, and she received the medal as the oldest descendant, which means that Medal of Honor has been part of my life ever since I can remember. And we have a big, big portrait, posthumous portrait of my grandfather. It's about 4.5 feet tall, hanging on her wall. So he was a huge presence in my life and in the family's life. Paradoxically, he'd also been somewhat put behind glass. So even my mother, his oldest daughter, and her sisters didn't really know that much about their father. And his widow, my grandmother, actually, she was a little frustrated with what happened after his death. He was very clear. He had shown leadership capacity from a young age. He was a man of astonishing assets and human like the rest of us. So in one letter that I found, my grandmother, she was frustrated that he was being referred to as what she called an eternal Sir Galahad.
So he signs up. He's in his early 30s. He actually not only was too old for the officer candidate school, he didn't have to go at all because at that time he was head of a mining company.
Yes. He really was not a guy who liked to sit at a desk, didn't like to wear a tie, didn't much like school. And he was quite upset after Pearl Harbor. And he said, you know, I'm going to go do my part. Well, with his family's connections, he certainly could have gotten into an officer's program or some kind of stateside in the Army or Navy or whatever it was. He said, nope, I want to be a Marine. And the Marine Corps said, well, you know, you're too old for our officer's candidate program, plus you're married. So he was married. He had three young children. And he was the head of a copper mining company in New Mexico, where he had gone to live in 1938. And, of course, copper is very critical to any war effort, even today, but especially then. So he was really thrice excused, but he was the kind of guy who liked to get his hands dirty and liked to get in on the action. That's what he chose.
So that kind of helps us understand what the term your grandmother used, Sir Galahad on a quest, a knight errant.
I think a knight errant is probably a very good description of him. A sometimes bawdy knight, I guess, if you will. Like I say, he was human like the rest of us, but he really wanted to get in and mix it up. And what I'm so lucky with this book because my family were great letter writers. And not only that, they were great savers. And not only that, but my great-grandfather had a fleet of secretaries at his disposal at Blue Diamond Coal Company. That was his company. And he had them copy everything pretty, I'm not joking here, in like octuplet. So there's tons and tons of copies. And what's interesting to me is my grandfather got to boot camp in San Diego with this kind of romantic idea of, you know, I'm going to be a grunt Marine like all these teenagers he was with. And he was disabused of that notion pretty quickly. The flip side of that is his leadership capacity was recognized fairly quickly by his commanding officers. So he changed his tune and thought, well, maybe I don't want to be a grunt. And actually, this is highly unusual. When he was just a corporal, his best friend at boot camp was a colonel. So that shows you the age difference. You know, he could relate to him. And that colonel did something very important, and that was he made sure that the documentation was there so that when my grandfather went overseas, he would be able, if he made the grade, to get field promotions to become an officer.
He wasn't going to be a grunt, but he becomes basically an engineer. Those of us in the Army know what the Corps of Engineers does, anything from building bridges to minefields and what have you. And so that's the kind of MOS, as they say, military occupation specialty, your grandfather had.
Yes, sir. Yeah, that's exactly the way to describe it. It was his MOS. He had experience in mining, not just through his copper mine in New Mexico, but he had also worked for his father on a couple of different occasions and also for some other companies, learning actually about demolitions and explosives. So sometimes I think of him as a big kid because he liked to blow things up, it seems.
Okay.
And I think that's a pretty good prerequisite for becoming an engineer in the military sense. This is not a guy who's sitting and drafting things. So as you say, they are bridge builders. They are demolitions experts. They're all those kinds of things. Actually, there's a piece that I found from the New York Times during World War II that I quote here in the book, praising engineers. It's an editorial on the New York Times editorial page. And it's just very poetic description of who these guys are and how important they were.
All right. So your grandfather ships out. And so let's pick up the story there. The next 18 months of his life.
Yeah. So he actually he hit boot camp San Diego July 1942. In October, as a corporal, he shipped out for New Zealand and was at Camp Judgeford in the Judgeford Valley with the 2nd Marine Division. That's north of Wellington, New Zealand, on the North Island. And, you know, they were training there, exercises going on. And, of course, what had been going on was, at the time, was that in August of 42, the 1st Marine Division had assaulted Guadalcanal. It was really the first major assault in that Pacific War, you know, beginning to knock the Japanese back. And so by the time he got to New Zealand, Guadalcanal was about halfway over. And then just after the new year in 1943, the 1st Marine Division had basically taken the island. It was mostly done. There was some mop-up. And so the 2nd Marine Division was sent in. He, as an engineer, his major duties were running a platoon of guys that were rebuilding a bridge over what was known as the Toha River. But they did actually see some combat because there were Japanese elements still. It's a jungle island still there. And they did run into and were ambushed by, I think it's 8 Japanese personnel. And that was his first taste of combat in, it would have been February 1943, I believe.
Okay. The planning for the island hopping, they tried their best to put out disinformation. They were supposedly going to one location when really they were headed to Tarawa.
Yes. It was October 1943, but after Guadalcanal, the 2nd Marine Division had done what they had been asked to do. Their army basically took over from them. They went back to the Judgeford Valley, and it was kind of a lull that was going on there. My grandfather got malaria. You know, a lot of the guys did. It was a tough time for them because they were kind of waiting on the edge of something. But in October, they were told to board ships, and they boarded in Wellington Harbor. And the Marines, many of the Kiwi guys were gone. They were over in North Africa fighting with the British Empire. And so, of course, a lot of the American guys had girlfriends who were very receptive to their charms, or so I read. And one of the reasons, of course, not just to put the Japanese off the scent, but also officers and commanders were concerned that if they told these guys, hey, you're heading out, you know, for battle, meaning you might not come back, they thought someone would go AWOL because of their girlfriends. So essentially, they misinformed them. They got on the ships, were told they were going up to the north end of New Zealand for exercises. And in fact, that wasn't true. They ended up going to Efate and Malay Bay in the Solomon Islands, where they would begin a very concentrated period of rehearsal, if you will, exercises for a full-scale amphibious attack on an island they still didn't know. They hadn't been informed of at that point.
Clay, we need to pause for a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Clay Bonnieman Evans about his book, Bones of My Grandfather, Reclaiming a Lost Hero of World War II. And so with planning for the attack, you know, rehearsing, what would be your grandfather's role? What was it planned that he would do or his unit would do?
His unit was assigned to be shore party. So for those who might not understand what shore party is, that's basically guys who are going to come in after the first waves. And their job, a very critical job, is to make sure that materiel and supplies get pushed forward to the forward lines as needed, whatever that is, water, ammunition, medical supplies. So he and his unit, which was 2nd Battalion, 18th Marines, which was an engineer unit, which also called Pioneer Unit, that was going to be their job on Tarawa. So presumably, I don't have a lot of documents specifically about the rehearsals, but presumably they were, you know, coming in behind the initial waves in those practice in assaults.
But that's not what really happened.
When they got to Tarawa.
When they got to Tarawa.
Well, so if I can just talk about Tarawa just a little bit.
Sure.
So Tarawa is a tiny little atoll. It's about 30 miles long. It looks a bit like a check mark or sort of the Nike swoosh. And it's flat, flat, flat. It's just sand and coconut trees. It's a bunch of tiny little sandy pearls, you know, islands with a beautiful lagoon. And it really didn't seem very important. At the time, it was known as the Gilbert Islands. It was a possession, protectorate of the British Empire. But in August 42, in part as a feint for Guadalcanal, Colonel Evans Carlson and his Marine raiders attacked Macon Atoll, which is actually about 150 miles north. And that different people have different interpretations. I think that raid was not a success. They were driven back into the sea. Several men were captured. 19 were beheaded. So it wasn't a great success, but it appeared to catalyze the Japanese decision that maybe they needed an airfield in this area. So in August, September 42, they began fortifying the tiny western terminal island called Basho and just ridding it of trees and building a big airfield and really heavily fortifying with concrete bunkers, steel reinforced, barbed wire, concrete, all, you know, obstacles all around the island to forestall any kind of an invasion. So that was Tarawa. And there were a number of things that really went wrong with the assault, I guess it's fair to say. The Navy had done some bombardment to soften up Basho as early as September of 43, possibly earlier, but I know it that early. And then right before the assault, which was scheduled to be November 20th, they just hammered it. I don't remember the exact number, 400,000 tons, which doesn't seem like a lot, but this is one square kilometer. So the Marines were told, and I've got letters, you know, from survivors saying this, there should be a cakewalk. We don't expect to see a lot of guys alive here. You're going to go in, you know, it's not going to be a big deal. So that was one issue. Another major issue was they needed to schedule this for a high tide because there's a huge fringing reef all the way around Basho. It's about 600 to 800 yards wide at places. And they needed to get what are called Higgins boats or LCVPs, which mm-hmm. were very famous flat bottom troop transports into that island. They also had tracked vehicles called LVTs, landing vehicles tracked. Those had tracks or wheels depending on the model. And they would be okay because when the water got too shallow, their wheels would take over and they'd drive to shore. The Higgins boats would hang up. They needed a 4-foot draft of water. So they had to go in at a high tide. The former New Zealand High Commissioner, who had been ordered off the island when the Japanese took over, said, well, I wouldn't go on that particular high tide because that is an apogean neap tide. And that means the lowest high tide of the year. And it has to do with the position in the moon. He said, I think you're going to find the water too shallow. And indeed, that is what happened. So those Higgins boats hung up on the edge of the reef.
So the Americans didn't pay any attention to the local guy who knew what he...
I don't want to say they didn't pay attention, but the way it's been portrayed in most history books is, sorry, this thing's in full motion and we really aren't going to stop it now. So I'd have to look specifically in the book to find out when he warned them, but he did give a warning. So between those two things... Unfortunately, and the heavy, heavy fortification of the island, it was a bloodbath. It was a disaster. It was 76 hours, 1,100 American forces killed, almost 5,000 Japanese forces killed in 76 hours, 6,000 people. So at the time, it was very swiftly called the bloodiest battle in Marine Corps history.
Okay. When does your grandfather come ashore?
As shore party, his job was to come in behind the initial waves. I've looked very long and hard. I found the after-action reports from his commanding officer, Colonel Chester Salazar, and so forth. And what's very clear is that he did not attempt to come in until late afternoon, 4:16 to be precise, of D-Day, which was November 20th, 1943. And the initial assault waves came in around 9. So when they first came in, there was a long pier that the Japanese had used to unload supplies and so forth. And the initial assault, they had attempted to take that. There were fires on the pier, but there were still Japanese forces on the pier. His unit had to report that they were not able, their job was to start unloading stuff on the pier, make sure, but they couldn't because the pier was still being held by Japanese. So, and there's some confusion, but I choose to believe the after action reports are very specific. So his unit was ordered to do two things. And three things, really, but help clear the pier, then establish beach security. And in fact, they also, for the rest of that day, D-Day, ferried wounded back out to one of the ships in the lagoon. So that's really what they did. And my grandfather, with another Marine, was put in charge of establishing a security perimeter right there on the beach.
Part of the story continues that there were Japanese fortifications that made establishing security almost impossible.
Yeah. This battle, I mean, the famous phrase from Colonel David Shoup, who was in command and actually crafted the plan of attack and was in command for the first couple of days, he said, "Issue in doubt." So it was really tough. They hit a about 3-foot-high coconut log seawall, so a lot of those tracked vehicles, they couldn't get up. They couldn't get up and over that until, you know, they had tanks that could blow part of that away. But overall, progress was being made fairly swiftly. So by D+1, the second day of fighting, you know, I think it was probably pretty clear at that point, especially after a night when there was no Japanese counterassault. There was a reason for that, but it was the Americans were going to take this battle. However, the part of the island, sort of the north central part where my grandfather had come ashore, that was being handled by 2nd Battalion, 8th Marines, commanded by Major Henry P. Jim Crow. And they were really hung up at the seawall in that part of the island. And that's because there were 3 machine gun positions that were fairly well protected. And they had interlocking fields of fire, and they were making no progress. They were hung up at that seawall for hours and hours and hours. One of those machine gun positions was a huge sand hill. They knew there was some kind of a facility underneath it, but they couldn't see it. I mean, absolutely hulking, highest thing on the island, you know, big, big pile of sand. And there was a machine gun position on top of that. So what the Marines of 2-8 needed to do, and my grandfather's unit 218 was attached to 2-8, was they needed to take out those 3 machine gun positions, or they weren't going to make any progress.
All right. We've got your grandfather's unit. They've got to eliminate the machine gun nests. And when you talk about the sand hill, it's more than just a machine gun nest. It's a bunker.
There's a huge... They knew there had to be a big building under there. They did not know what it was. It was covered with sand and coconut logs, and there were ventilation shafts on top. So I know the dimensions of the actual facility. So it was 49 feet by 56 feet. And about 15 feet high. So that's right. A big building.
Any remains of it still there?
Oh, yeah. The whole thing, really. It's getting a little dangerous because the concrete is beginning to flake off in there. And I've been told by some people that they wouldn't go anywhere near it. But it appears to be very solid. And I've been up and in and around it many times. Pretty remarkable that it's still there. But 2 of these machine gun positions were taken out, one by mortar fire. I'm doing this from memory, and I believe one from tank fire. That left the one last position up there on top of the bunker, and it was still holding them back. And that's really, my grandfather had done a number of other things. He'd already, they weren't ever able to act as shore party. He had full permission from his commanding officer, who committed him to assault action on that first day late. So there's some history out there that's not correct in some histories of the battle. One of the stories that's been told is he sat around twiddling his thumbs for the first couple of days. Absolutely not the case, not according to the after-action reports and letters and everything else that we know. So.
All right. Well, you think of the newsreels of assaulting Japanese fortifications in the Pacific, and you think of flamethrowers, explosive charges down the vent shafts and that kind of thing. So your grandfather now is basically given a combat role, and he captures the bunker.
Correct. So as an engineer, and again, some of this is from men who were there, who contacted me or I contacted them. And, you know, those are pretty old memories at this point, but they paint a very consistent story. And that is that my grandfather made his way. There's no distance, really. So it wasn't far for him to get to Major Crow. And what I was told by one survivor who said he was there and listened was that Major Crow was a little reluctant to use flamethrowers and TNT satchels and charges because he was concerned it was an ammo dump. And the story that this Marine remembered at a late age was that he recalled my grandfather, who was quite distinctive, yet he was very tall and he had a loud Southern voice, saying, I've worked demolitions, this, that, and the other thing, and I don't think they would build an ammo dump this close to the water. So he devised a plan. And I was told by another survivor that there was a mortar hit of some kind, perhaps even a shell from a ship in the lagoon, that blew some of the sand off the top and it exposed these ventilation shafts. And that may have given him the idea to use demolitions and flamethrowers to shoot down inside there and drive whatever forces were out two doors on the south and east side of the facility. So that was his plan. Major William Chamberlain, who was a little bit forward of Major Crow, said, yes, put it together. So he put together, counting himself, 21 guys. And then he led the assault with two other Marines and two others following shortly thereafter. And if people are interested in seeing what this looked like, it's very easy because, amazingly, it was filmed by Norm Hatch, who just died last year up in Virginia. But you can go and Google With the Marines at Tarawa. It's about a 10-minute documentary that won the Oscar in 1945. And I don't remember exactly when, but halfway or so through, you will see three men going up the backside of what looks to be a big sandy hill. At the beginning of that shot, the man on the right is my grandfather. At the end of the shot, John Borch, who has the flamethrower, is crossed over, so my grandfather's in the middle.
And the assault is successful, and almost 100 Japanese flee out and are then cut down.
And essentially, Harry Niehoff was flinging TNT charges up on top. John Borch was aiming flamethrower fire up on top, and that's how they took that gunner out. Once they took the gunner out, no problem. They were able to sweep up over the top, and then the rest of the Marines behind them were going to be able to come. And my grandfather organized and very specifically ordered that he had four Marines to work with, John Borch and a flamethrower, the others with demolitions. You on that vent, you on that vent. And sure enough, it worked very well. And it did flush at least 100, according to the Medal of Honor citation, Japanese out of those entrances. And there have been gunners placed out there to be able to take them down. So that's what happened. And then, again, there's some history that may have suggested otherwise, but in the process of researching this book and the other more contemporary piece, which I'm sure we'll get to, it's very clear that my grandfather then, and this is what he received the Medal of Honor for, as all this was occurring, he went to the leading edge of the bunker and stood and with his M1 carbine tried to withstand a rather furious and we presume lots and lots of Japanese coming up that far side of the bunker. And he is credited with killing at least three before he himself was killed.
He's killed. There were hundreds of Marines killed. They were then buried on the island. Obviously, in the tropics, it happens very quickly.
Yeah, this fighting was furious, and it's a tiny place, and there was no time to bury anybody. We don't know exactly how many, but certainly hundreds were killed in the water because of those problems we talked about earlier with the tides and so forth. So it was not a pretty sight when on November 23rd, major fighting was declared over. There was a unit that did chase some remnants of Japanese up to the top of the atoll where they were killed, but it was over, and the Marines had the unfortunate task of getting their comrades into the ground. Navy construction battalion bulldozers dug trenches. They wrapped most of their fellows in the ponchos, rubber impregnated canvas, because they were in bad shape. They'd been sitting in the tropical sun for 3 days, very bad shape. It was one journalist infamously or famously said that it would have been better if they could have sent in a million buzzards to clean up. So they did their best, the Marines of the 2nd Division, with help from chaplains to record who was buried where. But 4 days later, after the fighting, the 2nd Marine Division, every last man was gone. And then it was up to the Navy to rebuild that place. So inevitably, I mean, we don't know exactly how many were buried at sea, probably around 100. So basically 1,000 guys buried there on the island. And inevitably, in the work that happened, a lot of those graves just got lost is what happened.
Okay. And for years, the story was your grandfather was buried at sea.
Yeah. You know, one thing I found out And again, thanks to my great-grandparents, and I knew my great-grandmother for saving everything, is they were desperate to have their son. This just shattered the family. It was just terrible. They wanted his body brought home for burial. And so my great-grandfather worked assiduously, and then my great-uncle, my grandfather's younger brother for many years, then my mother for many years. And the family was given, like all families, there are many different excuses. I don't want to say excuses, explanations, but Army Graves went back in 46 and conducted an investigation and essentially recovered half, roughly half of those 1,000. And then what's interesting is even though they didn't know where the rest of them were, so probably 500 or so, they began telling the family different stories. Well, they were probably buried at sea, or maybe they were taken back to Hawaii as an unknown, or this or that, or there. And they built these beautiful memorial cemeteries. And the truth is, they didn't know where they were. And families weren't aware that they didn't know that they were still there.
And in fact, your grandfather raised a huge monument.
That's right. My great-grandfather bought at the base, it's about a 10-foot marble headstone. It says Bonneman on the front, and then bought 20 plots. It's on the top of the highest hill at a cemetery in Knoxville, Tennessee, just a couple miles from where their home was. And on the backside, he was brokenhearted. He put down all the information about my grandfather, his name, birth date and place and death and so forth. And at the very bottom, it says buried at sea. And you know, I think that was the one of the many explanations that my great-grandfather chose to accept. Out of the many explanations he'd been giving, perhaps that was the most comforting.
Clay, we need to pause for a moment, let our listeners know that this is Walter Edgar's Journal, and I'm talking with Clay Bonneman Evans about his book, Bones of My Grandfather, Reclaiming a Lost Hero of World War II. Well, in 1947, the Medal of Honor is presented to your mother. So does the family let things rest? When does the story continue about trying to reclaim your grandfather?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the way I think of it is it caused enormous pain and disruption in this family. It was quite a disaster for his family, and it was heartbreaking for his parents and everybody else. And, it was a great honor to have him receive the Medal of Honor. And I think that they kind of chose to make that the whole story and kind of put it behind glass because it was so painful. Now, my great uncle, George Gordon Bonneman, died in 2004. He was no slouch. He fought with Merrill's Marauders in the China-Burma-India Theater. Bronze Star, Silver Star, came out and left the Army as a major. He took up the quest to find his brother, my grandfather, for years, well into the 60s. And my great-grandfather died in 53, my great-grandmother in 68. And, you know, he never really dropped it. And then in the 1970s, my mom made a few cursory efforts. What's interesting about that is that I've got my mom's letters. She knew or should have known, because I have letters from the Department of the Navy saying, hey, he's still on Tarawa. So we should have known, but that's not what my mom told us. It's always been very difficult for her to talk about this, very painful for her. And so she even took us to the Punch Bowl in Hawaii, where his name is in the courts of the missing. And she said, well, he's buried here as an unknown. So that was the mid-70s. That's what we all thought.
All right. So who picks up the baton, so to speak?
Well, the man who really picked up the baton is a guy named Mark Noah. He's a civilian. He never served in the military. He's a commercial pilot. And he had volunteered his services with another recovery organization as a pilot and learned of this great mystery that there were all hundreds of mostly Marines, a few Navy personnel, and as it turns out, some Army personnel who were killed after the fight, after the battle. And Mark decided to make it kind of his mission. What he was doing at the time is he had a warbird operation. So he had 3 World War II airplanes, and he would do rides for veterans and so forth. He ended up selling those planes and privately fundraising so he could hire archaeologists, surveyors, and so forth, and go to Tarawa, and based on historical documents and everything that research he'd done, try to locate these remains. He just made it his mission.
Are we talking about what time, what year?
Mark started doing that in 2007. He discovered it. And in 2008, he had crews down there for a total of, I think, 2 months.
All right. Who's in charge of Tarawa now? It's no longer a British colony.
In 1979, the British gave them their independence. It is now known as the Republic of Kiribati, K-I-R-I-B-A-T-I. And if you think about Kiribati, it's sort of the way that they pronounce in their language the word Gilberts, Kiribati.
Oh, okay. All right. So about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, he begins this quest. Is it ongoing, continual research, exploration?
Yeah. It wasn't just Mark. There was another guy who just completely coincidentally, Mark's in Florida. This guy's in California named Bill Niven, Marine veteran. He was doing the same exact work. Synchronicity. And they both arrived at a bunch of conclusions that they thought they knew where some of these guys were buried. Well, Bill was actually, I say in the book, he's the pebble that got the avalanche going. Bill got on NBC News on Memorial Day weekend 2008 talking about this. And oddly, an alderman, a city council person in Chicago saw it. And he got interested, and then a congressman from Illinois, who was a Marine veteran and Democrat, and, you know, it snowballed from there. So really, in 2009, after all of this attention, based on Mark's research and Bill's research, Congress ordered, there was an agency of the Department of Defense, at that time known as JPAC, the Joint POW/MIA Accounting Command in Hawaii, and Congress ordered them to go to Tarawa and, based on this research, take a look. That agency had been created basically to look for MIAs in Vietnam and was not particularly interested in World War II battlefields. So they had to be kind of strong-armed into going down there in 2010. And I found out about it in late 2009. And when they were going, I just knew that I needed to go. So, you know, I wasn't under their auspices, but with their blessing and me paying for myself, I went down to Tarawa to watch what was going on.
All right. And how long were you there on the island?
Oh, that first time I was there, I think I was just there a week the first time, and I was there to watch and witness, and there was one area that they had planned to excavate during two months that was near where my grandfather was recorded as having been buried, according to research that Mark Noah had done.
Okay. But that first quest didn't turn up.
No. No. For a variety of reasons, and, you know, I won't go into a lot of it here, but they just I don't think they were all that interested in succeeding. I think that the agency at that time mostly just wanted to get Congress off its back and the press off its back.
All right. So this at this point, this is strictly a government agency.
Based on research developed by private citizens.
Okay.
So Mark continued with his organization, History Flight, to develop research in the years after that.
Okay. And what about the relationship with the Republic now? Public, is this private property, government property that they're digging on?
Yeah, you know, it's both. It's this little teeny island where the battle took place. There are about 25,000 people who live there. It's one of the most crowded places on earth. Most of them quite poor. They live in what you might call shanties. So yes, it's private, although land ownership isn't super clear. So it's a mix. For the most part, the government has been supportive, certainly supportive of the U.S. government's efforts.
Okay. And so after your first trip, you got more involved with what's going on.
I did. But I made a calculated decision that it wasn't going to be the Department of Defense that really got this done. And I really liked I barely knew Mark Noah, but I'd gotten to know how dedicated he was. And I thought, well, my mom was a little uneasy about this. And I said, well, Mom, people are going to look.
Why was your mom uneasy?
It's a scab for her. She doesn't like to have it pulled off. She doesn't like to talk about it. So painful, the memories of losing her father and everything. It really destroyed her family after.
Because one of the things you point out is your grandfather was a good correspondent. And he was actually, your mother was old enough to read the letters. And she received letters from him when he was in the
Many. Yep. Yeah. Yep. They're very sweet letters. Her younger sisters couldn't read and couldn't participate, but she was old enough to know. So he wrote her really amazing letters. You know, he was a very strong Catholic, and so often it was reminding her to, you know, to go to communion and make sure she made a confession. But also he was very, you know, do your chin-ups and do your swimming lessons and help mommy and all this stuff. They're very sweet letters, and my mom loved him dearly. He was away at the mine during the week, but he would come home on the weekends, take her to Mass, and she remembered holding his hand, and it was just very painful. So later in life, she was not really fond of talking about this in any specific way.
Well, did she ask you to back off?
She didn't. She was a little uneasy. She thought it was a little strange that people were looking for people who'd been buried in peace for so long. And I said, listen, people are going to look. Don't you think it's better that somebody from the family is involved? And she agreed with that. So I became involved with History Flight in a lot of different ways. I've been a volunteer for the organization doing all kinds of things, everything from PR to shooting video and photographs to contacting families to, I've dug holes. I'll do anything, really.
Okay. Well, let's get to the actual recovery of the remains.
So Mark had developed, based on what's known as individual deceased personnel files, casualty cards, and it said very specifically where my grandfather should be buried, and that was known as, it had a different name, but eventually it was called Cemetery 27. And we knew approximately where it should be. No trace of it had ever been found. But Mark was very interested in that part of the island. He wanted to recover all the, you know, the 500 or so who were left. But my grandfather had some notoriety because he was the only Medal of Honor recipient from the battle who was still MIA. So they had tried. They'd looked in different places. In 2013, Mark got a little disgusted with the government agency. He had heard, prior to that, just given them his research and backed off. He didn't think they were trying hard enough, so he started hiring his own archaeologists to go down. And in March 2015, in a private business right near the boat basin, opportunity arose to dig in there. And Mark had been very interested because there had been a set of remains recovered there in early 2000s. And in March, they indeed began finding remains there. And pretty soon, Kristen Baker, who was the lead archaeologist at that time, began making very strong provisional identifications based mostly on dental, but there were a few dog tags, different things. We knew that this was Cemetery 27 because we knew who should be buried there. That meant if the soil hadn't been disturbed, my grandfather should be in that trench. And Mark had told me, we think we're in there. And when it was confirmed, he said, I need you to come down and bring a video camera.
So you did.
I did.
And you were there when your grandfather's bones were.
I was. Yep. Yeah, I had butterflies. Kristen was very confident. Unfortunately, the soil can be disturbed there. People dig trash pits or there was a sewer line or whatever. And I knew that at any moment, this nice row of guys could be disturbed and we might not find my grandfather. However, she was very confident. And bing, 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 bing. And the documentation indicated he would be in grave. I'm using quote marks here. Number 17, meaning just location 17 within that trench. And on May 28th, 2015, while she was very carefully, it's very slow, painstaking work, uncovering the Marine in number 16, who was Private Emmett Kynes. I always like to remember him. The Marine next to him was exposed. And as she took the soil down, it became very, very clear that this was my grandfather next to him because my grandfather, from a wealthy family and older, had a mouthful of gold dental restorations. And we saw those right away.
All right. And you also discovered his cigarette lighter.
Yeah. You know, Mark, sort of as an ethical issue, didn't really want me, a family member, specifically working the hard work on those remains. But he did allow me to do a bit because I wanted to get my hands in. And one thing that I located was a big chunk of sand, you know, corroded metal crusted by sand. We didn't know what it was. Handed it to Mark. He has a hydrolyzing process that he does in his little hotel room down there. And it turned out there was a medallion of some kind we never identified, and it was my grandfather's Zippo lighter in pretty darn good condition. We can confirm it was his, very likely, because he had scratched his initial B on it.
Okay. And did you call your mom?
You know, you can't really call from down there. It's in the middle of nowhere, but I said, Mark was very nervous because we were still technically an outlaw organization. The government agency was aware that we were doing this work and they weren't trying to stop, but he didn't want anybody coming in and stopping us. So, but I said, I've got to tell my mother and my aunt and my sister. And he said, okay. So via the internet, I did let them know that we had found Alexander Bonneman, Sandy Bonneman, known as Bonnie to his buddies in the Marine Corps. And the next day, May 29th, 2015, Kristen led the full excavation of his remains.
And then he was brought home.
He was. You know, History Flight at that time was doing all the work necessary to do a full recovery. So the remains come out of the ground. They go to our lab. They are washed. They are dried. They are documented, photographed. A report is written. We bring in an odontologist for dental comparison. We did all that. The degree of confidence we had that this was my grandfather was, you know, I mean, it was a 1 in 10 billion chance it wasn't him, so obviously. And so we did all that. And then, you know, to my distress, we had no choice but to turn him and dozens of others that we had recovered over to the agency because they're the only ones legally empowered to make a legal identification. Well, after all that time, and there'd been a few little odd things that had happened over the years, I just wasn't that confident. I didn't like doing it. Mark said, don't worry, we're gonna make sure, you know, they don't delay this unnecessarily. But I'm a journalist and I've worked in PR. And I asked Mark if I could write letters to the head of the agency, the head of Marine Corps, House and Senate Armed Services Committees, senators from four states, saying essentially this. You have a choice of two headlines. Headline number one, big dumb government agency prevents aging widows from burying hero father. Or number two, Bonneman family grateful for the assistance of what was then called the DPAA. And 2 days later, literally, I was on a conference call with all those bigwigs. They understood what I was saying, and they were great. They were really great. They said, listen, your ID, this work is excellent. We're not going to hold on to it. And they promised we could have him back. They wanted to just do their own review, but we would have his remains back from Hawaii, sent to Knoxville in late September 2015.
And there was an official military funeral.
Oh, yeah. It was amazing. So Marine Barracks 8th and I, that is the unit that does the funerals at Arlington. They don't travel, but they did make an exception for this because it was such an extraordinary circumstance. So they came 8 hours on a bus, full color guards, a band, everything. We had a flyover of Marine aircraft, a missing man formation. We had family members who were clergy speak a few words. The day before, we had had his body lying in honor at the East Tennessee Veterans Memorial. It was just absolutely astonishing. It was 3 days of powerful, powerful memories.
So has the family monument been corrected?
People always ask me that. Well, you know, because now my grandfather is literally buried in front and I got the little headstone to match the rest for his brother and sisters and parents. They said, well, you know, are you going to have that buried at sea chiseled off the back of the headstone? And I said, absolutely not. I'm a storyteller and that is part of the story. So if you're not familiar with my grandfather's story, and you happen to go around back and you'd read that and it says buried at sea. And then you come in front and you see this headstone. You might scratch your head, but he is indeed buried there. His earthly remains are with his family.
And what about the rest of the folks that were recovered from that expedition? Are they still digging on Tarawa?
Yep. History Flight, I am happy to say that during all this, there was a full-scale reorganization of the nation's efforts to recover battlefield remains. And that was necessary and in part spurred by this effort and some of the snafus that happened. So now it's called the DPAA. They're doing great work. And History Flight, Mark's organization, actually works on contracts with them. So we have teams down there on Tarawa. We also work elsewhere, but that's where we're focusing. Pretty much year-round, the guys that we pulled out of that Cemetery 27 area, almost all, not all, much to my surprise, but almost all have been formally identified, sent back to their families. And every single time, it's just been a real powerful, moving experience. So at this point, just to say, History Flight has recovered I believe, more than 100 identifiable individuals. So making progress.
Well, this story does have a happy ending.
It really does have a happy ending. I mean, there's a lot of tragedy in here. And my mom is the one, you know, who really probably lived it more than anybody, because she was a child who remembered and lived through all the tragedy that happened after he died. But, you know, I begin the book with that little girl receiving that news. And it was a time when you just didn't talk about things. So, and then I end it with a Marine Corps general who did the funeral getting on his knee in front of that little girl who was at that point 81 years old and handing her a flag with tears in his eyes and speaking words that he didn't even repeat to me. He said, well, I gave your mom a private message. So it does have a happy ending and a remarkable story. Mark Noah and History Flight get all the credit. Mark is a bulldog. We nominated him, and indeed he was named by the U.S. Marine Corps an honorary Marine in 2015, and he deserves it.
Well, Clay Bonnieman Evans, sometime resident of South Carolina at Hilton Head and the author of Bones of My Grandfather, thanks so much for being with us today on The Journal. This is Walter Edgar, and I hope you enjoyed today's journal. The topic might be a little bit grim, but it's really a powerful story of a family for years trying to find out where their loved one's remains lay. It took the effort of private individuals prodding the U.S. government, but in the end, the remains of more than 100 Marines were found on Tarawa and returned home. In this case, Lieutenant Alexander Bonnieman was returned home to Knoxville, Tennessee, and buried in the family cemetery with his daughter and grandson present. It's a very moving story, and it's a part of all of our history. This is Walter Edgar. Join me next week for more of The Journal.
Walter Edgar's Journal is a production of South Carolina Public Radio. The producer and engineer is Alfred Turner. Production of this program is made possible in part by listener contributions to the ETV Endowment of South Carolina.
The views and opinions expressed on Walter Edgar's Journal are not necessarily those of South Carolina Public Radio.